Gathering up a few Singsapar leaves in his hand, the Buddha told his bhikkhus that of all the things he had found out, those which he had not revealed were as many as the leaves overhead, whilst those he had revealed were as few as the leaves in his hand. And he explained that he had not revealed whatever was not conducive to living the holy life, but that he had revealed what was conducive to holy living, to perfect wisdom, to Nibbana, namely the Four Noble Truths. With regard to the Dhamma he had revealed, he declared that he kept nothing back, making no distinction between the exoteric and the esoteric. Doubtless, the enlightened one made his entire teaching clear during the 45 years of his ministry to whomsoever sat at his feet. But more than 2 centuries passed by before the written records of his teachings began to appear. Do these records contain all that he taught, and exactly as he taught? Do some of them present only essential points in brief, omitting explanatory material? Have no alterations crept in through editing, through interpretations by other minds with the passing of the centuries? Furthermore, even assuming that the records contain the Buddha's own words, does your mind or my mind faultlessly grasp their meaning as it was in his mind? Take one example of a brief presentation omitting explanatory material. In the Samanya Phala Sutta, the Buddha tells King Ajatasattu, and in the Mahasakula Udayi Sutta, he tells Udayin, that a course has been pointed out, practicing which the learners experience various forms of psychic power, such as diving into the earth, walking on water, flying through the air, and even rubbing the sun and moon with their hands. The 37-page long explanation of this in the 12th chapter of the Visuddhimagga by Buddha Ghosha, who flourished 9 centuries after the death of the Buddha, seems in parts to be plain and open, while other parts stretch credibility to the limit and beyond. None of it, however, will enable me to rub the sun with my hands. Despite the apparent openness of the text, there is present the element of the hidden. If the text is to be read symbolically, then too there is the element of the esoteric. Let us turn now to another matter. Whilst the void is the habitat of pure mind, the manifest world of events, energy, or things, as apprehended by us through our senses and brain, needs the 4-dimensional continuum, the 3 dimensions of space, length, breadth, and depth, and the dimension of time. All physical substance and all forms of energy, such as electricity, light, heat, and so on, have different rates of vibration. Everything manifested is in motion. In ancient India, the primordial substratum of all manifestation was said to be non-moving, in equilibrium. When motion disturbed this equilibrium, different things and phenomena became apparent, having different rates of vibration. Several names were given to this primordial substratum. Some called it Prakruti, some Akasha, and so on. Akasha is immeasurable, infinite, inconceivable in any form sense. It is postulated by some teachers to be the origin of the world as both existence and non-existence, of physical substance and mind stuff. Like Nibbana, it is in some sense an absolute, for neither Akasha nor Nibbana is born of Kamma, of cause or of nature. See the Milinda Panhya for this, but there are other texts which give contradictory opinions. One meaning of Akasha is space. One synonym for Akasha is Shunya, the void, possibly comparable to the Inane of Lucretius in his work on the nature of things. He says in his De Natura Rerum, "But yet creations neither crammed nor blocked about by body, there is in things a void." According to the laws of Manu and the Sankhya and Vedanta systems, the order in which the grosser elements constituting the world are derived from Akasha is as follows. Akasha, air, light or fire, water, earth. Cicero gives the same order forwards and backwards, but omitting light or fire, in his work on the nature of the gods, the De Natura Deorum. The Taittiriya Upanishad gives this order: Atma, Akasha, air, fire, water, earth, herbs, food, semen, the person. The accounts of Akasha in the Hindu epics are inconsistent with those in the Puranas. Some say it was created and is perishable, while others say it was not created and is imperishable. Since the world is derived from Akasha, it may be infinite and eternal, or it may not. The Buddha classed these questions among what he called the indeterminates and refused to discuss them, as such matters did not conduce to living the holy life, to wisdom, to Nibbana. It is interesting, therefore, to note that the Buddha does use the word Akasha in several contexts. In the list of jhanas and samapattis, the first samapatti is presented as entering upon and abiding in the plane of infinite Akasha. And the jhanas and samapattis are extremely important in the Buddha's teachings. Again, explaining 8 causes of earthquakes, he states the first cause thus: "This great earth, Ananda, is established on water, water on wind, and the wind rests on Akasha. And at such a time as the mighty winds blow, the waters are shaken by the mighty winds, and by the moving water, the mighty earth is shaken." There are several parallels to this in early European writers. Did the Buddha mean his explanation to be taken literally? If so, we today naturally question whether every word of the Buddha is incontrovertible truth. But let us look at some of the other causes of earthquakes which he enunciates. An earthquake occurs when the Bodhisattva consciously and deliberately leaves the Tushita heaven, the heaven of pleasure, and descends into his mother's womb, and when he quits this womb. When the Tathagata arrives at the supreme and perfect enlightenment, and when he starts the Dhamma wheel rolling. When he consciously and deliberately rejects the remainder of his life, and when he passes entirely away, in that utter passing away in which nothing whatsoever is left behind. In relation to this last cause, are we not reminded of the earthquake and the darkness that fell on the earth and the rending of the veil of the temple at the crucifixion of Jesus? Do you think we can take all this literally? Did the Buddha speak openly or is there a hidden meaning? Let us try a different approach. Siddhartha Gautama, the seeker of perfect wisdom, of Nibbana, is the Bodhisattva whose ordinary life as the heir apparent in the palace is one of comfort and pleasure, his Tusita heaven. He looks into his own mind. The mind is the slayer of the real, says the Book of the Golden Precepts. It is the prolific womb of illusions. This womb, spoken of as Hiranyagarbha, the golden womb, is represented as a supreme god in the Rig Veda and as a type of consciousness in the Paingala Upanishad. The Bodhisattva deliberately and consciously turns away from the Tusita heaven of pleasure and enters the womb of his mother, the Lady Mahamaya. And Mahamaya means the great illusion. Thereupon, the earth shakes violently, and earth represents those aspects of the world which have physically reached their final expression, after which they must be broken up, and mentally reached that state of fixation, after which beliefs and dogmas, ideas and ideals must all be swept away by the invisible tide of truth. Is it not like an earthquake when you look into your own mind, break free from illusion, realize enlightenment, teach truth, cease to obstruct nirvana? We must meditate, not speculate, in order to come upon truth. We must perceive directly, not be tied up with concepts. You may feel that the above has an Upanishadic bias, and that it does not tally with the belief of many Buddhists that Gautama freed himself from all Brahmanical influence and teaching, even that he rejected it as incorrect, especially in connection with the Atma. Let us look into this with a quiet, open mind. In the Kita Giri and the Chanki Suttas, the Buddha says, "One who has faith draws close to the teacher, sits down nearby, and lends ear." But this was precisely the Upanishadic way. It is the very meaning of the word Upanishad. And that is not all. For the Buddha goes on to say, lending ear, he hears Dhamma, bears it in mind, tests the meaning, makes the effort, strives, and realizes with his person the highest truth itself, and penetrating it by means of wisdom, he sees. But this precisely is the Shravana, Manana, and Nididhyasana of the Adhyatma, Paingala, Narada, Parivrajaka, and other Upanishads. It is also, in essence, the way as laid down in the pre-Buddhistic major Upanishads. Let us investigate more deeply and fearlessly. In that revealing autobiographical discourse, the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the Buddha says, seeking the unborn, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana, I won the unborn, the uttermost security from the bonds, Nibbana. He repeats this formula again and again, substituting for the unborn the terms unaging, undecaying, undying, unsorrowing, unstained. Now listen to the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads. Yajnavalkya says to King Janaka, this great unborn Atma, undecaying, immortal, fearless, is Brahman. And to Kahola Kaushitakeya, the Atma is that which transcends hunger and thirst, sorrow and delusion, old age and death. In the Chandogya Upanishad, that is the Atma which is sinless, ageless, deathless, sorrowless, hungerless and thirstless. And the teacher Prajapati says to Indra and Virochana, the Atma which is sinless, ageless, deathless, sorrowless, hungerless, thirstless, 'tis that which should be sought out. I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, what other than the Atma was it that Siddhartha Gautama sought when he sought the unborn, the unaging, the undecaying, the undying, the unsorrowing, the unstained? For are not these the very terms in which the Atma was presented long before he was born? Consider again what Yajnavalkya says to Shakalya, to Maitreyi, and to King Janaka on separate occasions. That Atma is not this, it is not that. It is unseizable, for it is not seized. It is indestructible, for it is not worn out. It is the alone, for it is not attached to anything. It is unbound. It does not tremble. It is not injured. The Atma is not this, not that. Not a stone or a flower, not an ant or an elephant, not anything you can know with your mind. Not your body or your feelings or your ideas or your perceptions or your consciousness. Did not the Enlightened One confirm all this when he taught with endless patience that the body, the feelings and so on are not mine, these am I not, these are not the Atta of me? And did not the Buddha also say, because there is the not born, not become, not made, not compounded. If that unborn, not become, not made, not compounded were not, there would be apparent no escape from this here that is born, become, made, compounded. Are not these words of the Buddha his unequivocal affirmation of the Absolute, even as the terms of presentation of the Upanishadic Atma were the affirmations of the Absolute by the enlightened, liberated ones of Brahmanical India? How comes it then that whereas Brahmanical teachings blazon forth the Atma doctrine, Anatta is central to the Buddhist? The Upanishadic teachers sought answers to certain questions. What is the origin of the world as experienced by us? What is its relationship to that origin? Who or what are we? And what is our relationship to the Supreme Reality and our ultimate destiny? They answered that it is the Atma which becomes the whole world. They went further and said that not only does the Atma, the one reality, become the multitudinous variety, but also that it is this very variety. But this immediately raises a logical problem for us, which seems insoluble. We see that all this, the world, is mortal, is in bondage and pain, is measurable and conditioned. How then can the Atma be unitary, immortal, infinite, unconditioned, absolute, and also be its opposite, namely multitudinous, mortal, finite, conditioned, relative? The answer is simple to state, and I take full responsibility for this answer. It's not given as such in the Upanishads. The answer is simple to state, though difficult to comprehend. The finite and infinite, the mortal and immortal, are a non-duality. They appear to us to be irreconcilable opposites, because we, not being fully awakened, are not effortlessly aware that the totality is only one whole reality. Not clearly seeing all relationships, we are conscious in separatist terms. We are almost exclusively thing conscious and unawake in the mode of no-thing consciousness, that is, of an all-pervasive field consciousness. When thing consciousness and no-thing consciousness are integrated, unified as a non-duality, then there is whole consciousness in which, among other things, there is no division into what is commonly termed the conscious and the unconscious. The Upanishadic teachers also had another term for ultimate reality, namely Brahman, an objective term, the philosophical absolute. They experienced its reality by going beyond the uttermost deep of their own consciousness. If Brahman, the totality, were to announce itself and say, I, that I is the meaning of the term Atma, a subjective term. It is this subjective flavor which is responsible for using the word self with a capital S as the equivalent of Atma, despite the fact that the word self is a misleading word. What I have called whole consciousness is the pure or absolute consciousness which is the meaning of Atma as presented in the Varaha Upanishad. The Buddha talks of it. It comes in the Majjhima, the first volume, page 329, and it also comes in the Digha, the first volume, page 223. The Buddha talked of it in these terms: Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam. That consciousness which is invisible, attributeless, unending, shining everywhere. Also, I regard Atma as the eater up of the mind. Now, when no-thing consciousness functions as freely as thing consciousness, we are effortlessly awake to the complete relationships between all apparently separate entities and states of mind. Thereupon, the mortal and the immortal, the finite and the infinite, are for us a non-duality, quite simply and factually. And love, the unifier and healer, is in full flower. We must note carefully that the Atma is, but that the world exists dependently upon Atma. To exist, from the Latin existere, means to come forth, to emerge, to appear out of. The world appears out of, or is an appearance of, Atma. The unborn, undying Atma is the timeless, the immeasurable. The world is the born and the dying, the measurable, the incessantly changing. Whilst on the one hand, the Upanishadic teachers declared that the Atma becomes and is all this. On the other hand, they designated all this as not Atma. They bridged the contradiction by presenting Atma as immanent in the form of things and also as transcendent in the formless no-thing. Yajnavalkya says to Uddalaka Aruni, "He who, dwelling in the earth, yet is other than the earth, whom the earth does not know, whose body the earth is, who controls the earth from within, he is your Atma, the inner controller, the immortal." This statement is repeated over and over again, substituting for the word earth the words fire, sky, atmosphere, etc. in relation to the world, and the words life, speech, eye, ear, mind, etc. in relation to each person. Yajnavalkya ends his exposition thus: "He, the seer, is unseen. He, the hearer, is unheard. He, the thinker, cannot be conceived of. He, the all-knower, cannot be comprehended. There is no seer, hearer, thinker, or knower but he. He is your Atma, the inner controller, the immortal." And note carefully his last sentence: "Everything else is of evil, dukkha." The Sanskrit is atonyad artham, which also means leading to misery, destruction, death. Note the personalistic element in the presentation of the immanent Atma. Here is the stumbling block to understanding, because of the tendency to picture it as an immortal entity. And in fact, the Upanishads did talk of it as being of the size of a thumb, smaller than a grain of rice, greater than the earth, and as being seated in the heart. The term immortal entity is self-contradictory, for any entity is finite, and as such, it must of necessity come into being and cease to be. Those who, unlike Yajnavalkya, were still not fully enlightened, tended to identify this immanent Atma, pictured as a mannequin soul within the body, with the body, or with different states of consciousness, such as the dream state, the deep slumber state, etc. The Buddha also talks of this in the Digha Nikaya. Their awareness was still largely confined to thing consciousness. Hence the confusion and the inability to realize the mortal and the immortal, the absolute and the relative, as a non-duality. This non-duality of the absolute and the relative is expressed in the Prajnaparamita and the Madhyamika of Nagarjuna as shunyata, that is, emptiness. The germ of this lies in the Buddha's words to Kacchayana, where he points out that the world usually bases its view on two things: existence and non-existence. It is and it is not are the two extremes between which the world is imprisoned. But the Tathagata teaches a dharma in the middle between them. This dharma is presented in the Theravada as the Paticca Samuppada and in the Mahayana as Shunyata. The absolute is emptiness. Also, all things are empty. In their emptiness, Nirvana and this world coincide. Nirvana is not different from birth-death, that is, from samsara. Shunya is not a mere nothingness. Bear this in mind also in relation to the Upanishadic Atma. Shunya literally means relating to the swollen. The root of shunya is shvi, which seems to have expressed the idea that something which looks swollen from outside is hollow inside. If I may use an unusual expression, this inside hollowness of an outside swelling, and here you will get a feel of the meaning of akasha, is the emptiness. Not a mere nothing, not a blank. It is a term for the absence of self, for not Atma or Anatta. Both Nirvana and all things are Shunya, Anatta as the texts put it. Now consider very intently. Are they void of self, or, if I may so suggest, are they void of selfness, of the conceptual self, which is self as we ordinarily imagine it? Is anatta absolutely no atma, or does it mean no separate atma? No my atma or your atma, which would precipitate us into the obvious mistake of the Manichean soul as an immortal entity, a self-contradictory term. Contemplate this, but contemplate it in the state of utter silence. Listen again with an open mind. The Atma, or the Buddha's unborn, undying, unbecome, transcends any changeless being or any ephemeral becoming. To transcend means to be wholly other than and yet not separate from. If you can see this, in you will arise the peaceful understanding that Atma, Shunyata, deathlessness or Nirvana, all defeat the mind which is active in its stained condition. But when the mind is in equilibrium in its pure condition, it is in the state of enlightenment with the unknowing knowing. Then there is Nirvana. But you, the outside swelling with the hollow inside, do not know it during the actual experiencing. It knows itself non-mentally. As I have said on other occasions, awareness and being are identical in the transcendence. His Holiness Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet, says in his book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye, that the teaching of Nairatmya, Anatta, is upheld by all schools of Buddhist thought, that the Atma view, namely, the belief in some permanent soul entity, is the root of all trouble, and that it is because of the Atma view all beings are wandering on in the realm of samsara. Please note very carefully the exact words. The Atma view, according to Buddhist definition, is the belief in a permanent soul entity. But this Manichean soul and all that is associated with it, the skandhas and dharmas, is precisely what the Upanishads call not Atma, Anatta. There is, in truth, no real disharmony between the Upanishads and the Buddha Dhamma. The trouble arises only out of our own confusions and lack of clear insight, our own bias and prejudice, and incomplete investigation. Enough has been said to indicate that the misconception of Atma as a privately possessed immortal entity, a mannequin soul, had spread in Brahman circles. When Siddhartha Gautama realized enlightenment, he saw the situation clearly. The transcendent, unborn, unbecome was that which was ungraspable and inconceivable, and with which, in the words of the Mandukya Upanishad, there could be no dealing whatsoever. There could only be the silence in connection with that. But this, the faring on through samsara, was what we could deal with. So he taught the Dhamma, which he characterized as deep, difficult to see, tranquil, excellent, not to be understood by mere logic, subtle, but intelligible to the wise. This Dhamma is the Paticchasamuppada, causal uprising by way of condition. It presents the rationale of dukkha. It exposes the mechanism of samsara. It shows the uprising and extinguishing of the whole mass of dukkha. Where the diagnosis is right, the cure is at hand. What the Buddha called dukkha, the Upanishads called bandha, bondage. The Sarvasara Upanishad says, the Atma, that is the unborn, undying, unstained, identified with the body personally or with any manifestation universally, is bondage. Freedom from such identification is liberation. That which causes this identification is ignorance, the unawakened state. That which removes this identification is wisdom, the awakened state. Indeed, then, the Buddha taught the way to liberation when he taught anatta. Now, Sariputta lays down that ignorance, the first and basic factor of the Paticchasamuppada, is the not knowing of the Four Noble Truths. Since ignorance is the main root of suffering or of bondage, and since wisdom, the awakened state, is the foundation of nirvana or liberation, the whole of dukkha or of bondage is most intimately concerned with the mind. The texts clearly show that samsara, as the universal becoming process, has no beginning or ending. And yet, the dukkha afflicting our minds individually can be extinguished, whereupon our samsara, purified of all stains, is suffused with nirvana. Dukkha and its cause, craving, announced in the first two noble truths, lie in the worldly context of mortality. The third and fourth noble truths, the extinction of dukkha, which spells nirvana, and the eightfold way, belong to the transcendent context, not the worldly context. The eightfold way is the perfect way, and perfection is transcendent. The Mahayana presentation of the path points to this rather more than the Theravada does. The Eightfold Way is the complement in the transcendent context of the Paticchasamuppada in the worldly context. The Buddha, like all other great teachers, without exception, gave the transcendent answer to each and every worldly problem, and only the transcendent answer. Much lies hidden in the open words of the teachings. Let us consider the fourth factor in the Paticchasamuppada, namely nama-rupa, usually translated as name-shape, as mind-body, and as materiality-mentality. Nama, mind, is explained, for example, in the Visuddhimagga and in the Abhidhamma, as the three khandas or aggregates of feelings, perceptions, and mental formations or states. How does the Vedanta present nama-rupa? Brahman, the Absolute, through maya, the illusion-making power, gives rise to Brahma, the Creator. Both the Creator and his creation is the product of avidya, nescience. For all creation is but the ephemeral thought or dream of the Creator. As such, it constitutes the whole realm of dukkha. And yet at the same time, with that charming illogicality which has its own say in creation myths, knowledge is the only predicate which all religions ascribe to the Creator. If one asks, what are the objects of knowledge or the thoughts of Brahma? The answer is, names and forms, the nama rupe in the plural. Up to a point, these are similar to the ideas, the ID of Plato, the species of the later Stoics, the samvijna dharmas of the Buddhists, the logos that was called by Philo long before St. John, the uios monogenes, the alone begotten. The nama rupe were the creative logoi, the gods such as Agni, ruler of earth, Vayu of air, Surya of sky, the archetypes. Brahman, the Absolute, communicates by means of names and forms with this universe, which extends as far as name and form extend. The Buddha refers to these Vedic gods, Sakka, Prajapati, Brahmasahampati, and the whole host of them, who are but ephemeral nama-rupe, for they are born and they cease to be. Now, the whole process of liberation entails the complete negation of this world, the complete reversal of the ordinary human condition, namely dukkha and the darkness of ignorance, the unawakened state. But you cannot negate the world as a physical fact. The enlightened and the ignorant alike do live and have to live in the world. The negation is the negation of the world as conceived by the unenlightened mind. And it takes place in the mind as one enters deeper and deeper into the jhanas, the profounder states of consciousness, steadily disentangling oneself from all forms, and especially the mental forms which are our concepts, not our direct percepts, which is a different matter. Rupa is akasha constrained into illusory form, and nama is mind inclining to rupa. And the interlocking of these two with vijnana is the existential being, you or I, he or she. In the deep samapattis, the constrained akasha and vijnana are freed into their natural state of infinity, and nama and rupa vanish as obstructors to wisdom. As one goes deeper into melting, all the archetypes and all the gods dissolve. And this is a terribly painful process. The great mystics of the world called it the dark night of the soul. They exist, the gods and the archetypes, only as long as the beliefs and memories and devotions of men in the unenlightened state give them continuity in the mind. As the Tibetans say, gods, demons, the whole universe are but a mirage which exists in the mind, springs from it, and sinks into it. And in that delightful discourse entitled A Challenge to a Brahma, the Buddha reveals the same truth to him who has eyes to see. It is the conceptualizing mind which paints the picture of spiritual beings and forces and all the furniture of heaven and hell. The concept, tree or dog, is not the actual tree or dog perceived in the immediate living here now. The movement through the jhanas sweeps the mind clean of the mountainous heap of concepts, of vain beliefs and fixed ideas, of age-old powerful archetypal images, and of any and every idol of divinity, howsoever exalted in our fond fantasy. But this can happen truly and without self-deception, and happen safely only if there is the firm basis of pure morality. And then you will know death. Not death, the deliverer of the wages of sin, but death, the perfecter and consummator. You will know it peacefully and fearlessly. And for the first time in your life, you will be filled with the wonder of creative renewal from moment to moment. For when the mind is pure, empty, transparent, luminous, then egoistic self-consciousness is no more. Instead, there is what the Buddha called vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato bhavam, the awareness which is attributeless, unending, shining everywhere. Such a mind is perfectly clear-seeing, for it offers no obstruction to the free functioning of the liberated intelligence. Free of all stains, wholly attentive without any grasping to the flow of life here now, you are free of psychological time and all the sorrow it holds. The timeless eternal, because of your fully awakened state, is embodied in every moving flicker of time. Therefore, every instantaneous birth, that is, every uprisen state of mind, is completely worked out, leaving no residue whatsoever. This means that you die wholly to every fleeting moment whilst alive in the body. Where there is the perfect rhythm of birth and death, you see the dance of life. You experience the deathless state, the nirvana that is never born nor ages nor dies. You enjoy the rose of your salvation under the light of heaven.